Well, if you've been with us for the last few weeks, we've been talking about dreams, and not the kind of dreams that you have when you're asleep, but dreams that are hopes, and dreams that are not just little hopes, but really, really big hopes. Dreams that are so big, they become like part of your identity and part of your core, something you want so much that it kind of shapes the way you do life, and you kind of interpret things you see around that hope, and that hope, it just becomes so central to us. But then because we live in a broken world, a world broken by sin, a world that oftentimes is unsafe and oftentimes unfair, sometimes our dreams die. And sometimes they die slowly, they just fizzle, and sometimes they pop with a big bang. But what, you know, how we navigate that, how we navigate our dreams dying is huge. Those moments of dreams dying are turning points. They're watershed moments for us in our walk with God. And so how we navigate that, you know, how we navigate our dream dying, and who is God in the midst of that, and is he still who he says he is? Is he still loving and kind in the midst of those dreams dying? Those questions are huge for us. And so that's where we've been in the book of Lamentations. We've been through chapters 1 and 2, and as we get to chapter 3, this morning, I want to share a little bit about my story. And it's not just my story. It belongs to Erin, my wife, as well. And like Pastor Bob said, we've been married for 9 years, almost 10 years this fall, which it's just crazy how fast it goes. And as we kind of reach back in our marriage to where our story begins, it was when we had been married for about 3 years, and I was finishing up my degree at Co to be a teacher, and Erin was already working at St. Luke's, and we decided that, you know, let's start trying to have kids. Let's start a family. Let's grow our family. This seems like the right time. You know, we were living in this dumpy little apartment. We were going to move out. And so I think, you know, Erin was maybe ready a little bit before I was, but I got ready pretty quick. And so this dream started to kind of take flight and kind of fill up with air. And, you know, for me to get into a dream, whether it was the dream to have kids or other dreams, I go first to Microsoft Excel. So I go first to a spreadsheet, and I make sure that my dream works. Like, I make sure that the money correlates to when we want to have kids, and then the spacing works out, and, you know, I make sure that the timeline works for buying a house, and then it would, you know, correlate to when my, you know, my job would have raises. I didn't even have a job yet, but I figured, the spreadsheet was, that's how my dream kind of took flight, and it just, you know, I got into the spreadsheet, and Erin was way more worried about, like, names and colors of baby rooms and stuff like that, but I was way into my Excel spreadsheet, and I don't think we really realized how big that dream was for us until the dream wasn't working. I don't think we really realized how badly we wanted to have kids or how much that was wrapped up in our identity until 1 month turned into 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and we realized it was a dream when the dream started dying slowly. And, you know, month to month, we got on this really vicious cycle of anticipation and hope, of hoping we'd be pregnant that month, and then disappointment and let down when we weren't. And the cycle really picked up speed as it got more expensive, and as time rolled on and we got more doctors involved and more medications, and it just got really expensive. And so you throw financial stress into the expectation and hope, and that cycle was just out of control. And the month-to-month hope and anticipation followed by letdown, the letdown turned into despair. It was like, God, is this ever going to work? You know, you start asking big questions. You start asking questions about, you know, is God still loving in this? You know, and I guess I'll just pause right there and just acknowledge that your dream is probably very different from mine. In fact, you're maybe here today and you're like, my dream is to not have kids. I'm fine without right now, thank you. And that's great. You know, your dream might be to just finish high school right now, or your dream is to just get a job. You know, maybe it's to find employment at all, or maybe it's that next career change, that fulfilling job that you really want. Or maybe your dream is about family restoration and, you know, bringing reconciliation to relationships. It could be a dream for a marriage to get healthy. It could be so many things. And I would just really challenge you to kind of tap into whatever your dream is this morning and kind of carry it with you for the rest of my story. And then as we look at Lamentations chapter 3, because your dream is not my dream, but your dream is crucial to how you kind of navigate your life. You know, in many situations, that dream was given to you by God, and it kind of helps to shape who you are. But it's fragile. We live in a world that's broken by sin, And so I would really just challenge you to kind of tap into your dream as I'm talking, because my dream is probably not your dream. Our story continues, and we got pregnant about a year and a half after starting to try. And we were obviously excited but nervous because we wanted this so badly, but we were just unsure. It was like it took so long to get here that when you finally have it, it's like, is it going to last? Like, we had just been wanting this so badly that now we were here, we weren't sure if we could even keep it. And so week after week, we're just kind of slowly getting comfortable with it, slowly letting our guard down. You know, we felt, you know, this dream kind of fill back up with air. It had been leaking air hardcore for the last year and a half. And then it started to kind of fill back up, and we were excited. And we got to the 12-week appointment where we would hear the heartbeat. Went to the doctor's office, and, you know, they bring in the little sonogram machine, and they couldn't find a heartbeat because there wasn't one. And we had lost the baby somewhere earlier in the pregnancy. And, you know, those moments, I'm sure you have them too, when just kind of burned into your mind and into your memory when dreams take a hit, when dreams either take a big let of air out or pop altogether. And, you know, in the doctor's office room when there was no heartbeat was one of those moments for me of just air rushing out of the balloon. And those questions that we were asking throughout the process of trying to get pregnant, you know, God, are you good in this? Like, is this what you want? Like, you wrestle with these questions, especially when what you want is wholesome and glorifying to God. I mean, God designed us to, you know, in the garden, he charged Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply. He designed marriage. He designed having kids. So it's like, it's not like we wanted something stupid. It's not like we wanted something that wasn't glorifying to God. We wanted something that was good. And so in kind of the aftermath of losing this baby, we were asking these questions all over again. Like, God, if we want something good, how easy would it be for you to help us have a baby? I mean, there's how many billion people on the planet? Obviously, it's not complicated for you. You give people babies all the time. Why not us? Why is this not working? You know, where is your love in this? Where is your love? Where is your goodness and your faithfulness in this? We don't feel it. And in those moments, we sensed and we started to feel a potential to drift. These moments for us were some of the darkest individually and in our marriage, where for the first time, substance abuse became a very real possibility. It was like, this just makes sense all of a sudden. Like, I'm not sure it really made sense to me before this season of my life, where it was like, man, we could numb the pain really quick. And in the darkness and in things that don't make sense, you can drift. And drift to places that you didn't know were there. Drift to places you don't want to go, but you find yourself drifting without an anchor. And in the aftermath of losing that first baby, we stayed there for a while because it was not a clean process of moving on from the miscarriage. It was long and complicated for Erin, and procedure after procedure to try to help her body move on from the pregnancy, and we just had to kind of linger in this dream die. I mean, we couldn't move on. We had to stay there and kind of relive it every day that this baby was gone, and we had to stay there for weeks and weeks and weeks. And those questions were very real, and I'm sure you have been there too, where it was like you're almost forced to live in the middle of your dream dying for longer than you wanted to. Well, you didn't want your dream to die at all, but then when it did, you're like, can't I just move on? And so you're in those moments, and I think in your dream dying or your dream at all, you can kind of put yourself in that situation. And in many ways, it's the questions that Jeremiah has been asking and the difficulty that he's been having in processing his dream dying. And so our story continues. After we were given the green light from the doctors to start trying again, we did get pregnant again. And obviously with this one, you know, we're like hyper nervous and like on pins and needles and extremely anxious and tense. But we made it through the appointment to hear the heartbeat. We made it through all of the milestones, and we got to our due date. Our due date was July 17th, and sure enough, on July 16th, it was time to go to the hospital. Hooray for spreadsheets. It was right on time. Actually, that's not true, because the spreadsheet was totally blown to shreds at this point. Nothing worked, according to my spreadsheet. But it was a good attempt. And so July 16th, we go to the hospital, and it just felt like our dream finally kind of came back together. And it was finally going to work. And this thing that had started now almost 3 years ago was finally going to take flight. And we got to the hospital, and the labor was long, and long turned into complicated very quickly. After a long, long time of trying to have this baby, the doctors were like, we have to get the baby out right now. And we were far enough along that they didn't do a C-section. They could vacuum, sorry. I haven't told this story very many times to big groups of people. So they vacuumed Tommy out, and this dream that was just about ready to take flight just like died, like literally. Tommy was, saying mostly dead is kind of an odd thing to say because he's either dead or he's not dead, but his body was not living. His heart was beating, but he wasn't breathing, and he had gone without oxygen for so long that they immediately, pulled the code button, and you hear that alarm, and you see doctors and nurses rush in, and you see this, your dream born and then die, literally. And, for those first moments and hours, we thought that that was it, that we're right back to where we started. And you talk about asking hard questions. We've been asking hard questions all along. And then you just ask the question, God, really? Like, really? Is this going to keep going? When is this going to stop? And so we spent the next couple weeks in the NICU kind of getting doctor visits and having them, they just lit Tommy up with wires and tubes and everything and put him on a cooling blanket so that his body would kind of slow down and then basically put him into kind of a hypothermic state to stop the brain damage. And over the course of the next couple weeks, we kind of got a better picture of what his future and our future would look like. And in many ways, it was unknown. There wasn't a clean answer. It wasn't like, hey, we did it. We saved him. We got him breathing again. They had to intubate him, and he didn't breathe on his own for a long time. And even after they got him breathing, he was seizing, and seizing through lots of medication and just all kinds of challenges. And even after all of that was stabilized, the doctors were still like, I don't know. He could be anything from a normal little kid with nothing. You'd look at him and say, wow, that happened to you. We'd never know. All the way to, he might not know who you are. He might not walk. We just don't know. They could see evidence of brain damage in the MRI, and they could see evidence of organ damage, which would indicate that his body went without oxygen for a long, long time, and so they didn't know. And it wasn't until quite a while later that he was diagnosed with cerebral palsy, which, again, doesn't give us a lot of answers, but it kind of puts some perspective in there that, yeah, this happened. And it's real. And we don't know. He's continuing to grow and meet milestones and differently than other kids, but he's growing. And we just don't know. We continue to live in this unknown. We continue to live in kind of this limbo state of like, God, is our dream dead or is it not? And there are days when it seems like the dream just fills up with air and it's just going and we've got it and it's all good. And then there are days that through all kinds of therapies and doctor visits and continue evaluations, there are days when it just feels like it's over. Like, this is just, it's done. And we just live there in kind of this, like, inflate, deflate, inflate, deflate, pop, inflate, deflate. It just goes on and on and on. And that's where we are and probably will be for a long, long time. And so this really brings us to chapter 3 of Lamentations. This really brings us to the questions that Jeremiah was asking. Big, big questions. Questions of, is God still loving and is God still good? Is he loving when your dreams die? It's a question you have to answer because your dreams are going to take a hit. We live in a broken world, a fragile world, and when they die, we're going to ask those questions. And thank God he gave us a book. He gave us Lamentations, which is Jeremiah's gut-wrenching processing through this question of, is God still good when dreams die? And so I want to give you just kind of a snapshot review of Lamentations and kind of where we are in this, because we need that to kind of make sense of what is so significant in chapter 3. So here's kind of just a little snapshot, and we're going to go way, way, way back. We're going to rewind quite a ways. Here's kind of the rewind. Israel was God's chosen people. Yeah, we're going way back. Israel was God's chosen people, chosen and set apart to be a blessing to the rest of the world. They were set apart to be a beacon and a lighthouse to the nations. And because they were set apart, blessed, and chosen to be a lighthouse, they were given extra laws and extra festivals and rituals, and they were given symbols of that special blessing. They were given many things to signify that unique covenant relationship with God. And one of the biggest ones, one of the ones that formed kind of the core and their national identity, was the temple. It was God with us. It was a physical building where God would dwell in their midst, in their presence. It was God with us. God's chosen people, he is their people, and he is their God. Or they are his people, and he is their God. And this was everything to the Israelites. God's temple, God with us. And as their story grew and as time went on, they got lost. They drifted. And I mean, not just like drift, like, oops, we kind of got lost. It was like big time drifting. Falling away, running away from God. And he sent messenger after messenger, prophet after prophet, to bring them back. And these prophets weren't like, hey, it's not so great right now. You kind of need to come back. The prophets were like, you don't understand. This is like adultery. This is like a spouse cheating. That's what you're doing. Because these weren't little things. Israel had gone to the nations around them. They had gone to other nations and borrowed practices from their idol worship and brought them into their special relationship with God. They had cheated on God, essentially, like a spouse would cheat. They had polluted this precious relationship. They had absolutely broken it. Awful things like child sacrifice and temple prostitution, building altars that God didn't want, worshiping gods that were no gods at all. And so prophet after prophet, messenger after messenger, calling the people back, come back. Jeremiah was one of them, weeping, weeping. I mean, Jeremiah's life was just poured out for the people, asking, begging, pleading for them to come back. And the people oftentimes were like, yeah, it's not really that bad. And Jeremiah was like, yes, it is. God's going to bring the Babylonians, and he's going to punish this. This sin is not okay. God does not tolerate sin. And if you think about it like a spouse cheating, God is not going to sit back and tolerate you cheating. Not okay. In fact, he's ready to bring the Babylonians, like right now. Like the Babylonians, he's getting them ready. You've got to come back. And people were like, we've got the temple. God's not going to bring the Babylonians. Why in the world would God bring the Babylonians to destroy Jerusalem? We have the temple. God's not going to let his temple get destroyed. And the people had this warped sense of what it meant to be in a covenant relationship with God. And so God brought the Babylonians. And it was an awful, ugly thing. The Babylonians destroyed the walls, starved out the people, killed the priests in the temple, razed the city to the ground, took the people into exile. And here's Jeremiah in Lamentations, angry, confused, totally ripped apart. And in chapters 1 and 2, asking these questions, God, how could you be so thorough in your judgment? How could your wrath be so thorough to let us get wiped out? Why so much? I mean, we needed punishment, but why so much? And he asks these questions in chapters 1 and 2, and even as we start chapter 3, he's angry and he's confused and he is just totally drifting. He's accusing God, he's angry, he's bitter, and his focus is right on the dream. Like Pastor Seth talked a couple weeks ago, sometimes when our dreams die, we keep it right here. And that's where Jeremiah was, that's all he could see. And then we get to chapter 3. Lamentations chapter 3. He starts off chapter 3 continuing to be angry and accusatory. And then he gets to verse 19. I remember my affliction and my wandering, the bitterness and the gall. I remember them. I well remember them. And my soul is downcast within me. Yet this I call to mind, and therefore I have hope. Because of the Lord's great love, we are not consumed. For his compassions never fail. They are new every morning. Great is your faithfulness. I say to myself, the Lord is my portion. Therefore I will wait for him. The Lord is good to those who hope in him. It is good to wait quietly for the salvation of the Lord. And so you read this and you're like, Jeremiah, are you insane? Like, literally, are you insane? You've been lamenting for three chapters now about how God was too harsh, too cruel in his judgment. And then you're going to say that God is loving in the midst of this? In fact, not just loving, but great love? And the words he uses here are calling to mind his covenant love. Not just any love, but his promise to love, his hesed love, the love that said, I will love you always. Jeremiah is summoning that love. And so we read this and we're like, Jeremiah, how in the world is God loving in the midst of this situation? That's not possible. It's not possible. It's not possible that God, you're compassionate in the midst of this dream dying. But he was. And there's two things that I think we can see in this. The first one is that God sent prophets to warn the people and call the nation back to himself. God was loving in this situation in that his heart was for the nation to come back to him. His heart was not for destruction. We see in Ezekiel that God doesn't take pleasure in the death of anyone. His goal was for the nation of Israel to be restored back to him like a spouse coming back. And he sent prophet after prophet. His love chased the people. We sing a song called Fierce that God chases us. He was chasing the Israelites in the midst of this. His love was present. But we see another evidence of God's love, and that is that he did not give them what they deserved. His judgment was executed, don't get me wrong. But if the people got what they deserved, the nation as a whole would have been wiped out, wiped clean, done. But he didn't give them what they deserve. He spared a group of people. Some of the people were left by Nebuchadnezzar in the city, and some were taken into exile. But he left some. He spared some. He spared some people to be the continuation of his promise, to be the continuation of the nation of Israel. That in and of itself, in our 2017 Western brains, we think, no, that's not evidence of love. Well, to the God of the universe, to a covenant God who doesn't tolerate sin and poured out his judgment on a sinful nation, sparing anyone is love. Because God doesn't tolerate sin, and so sparing anybody, continuing on this promise at all, was supreme evidence of God's love. And Jeremiah sees that. He sees that when he says it, and the NIV translates verse 22, we are not consumed. Other translations don't have that idea of not being consumed, but Jeremiah says, because of your love, God, we weren't wiped out. You left some people. And so this shift starts to happen for Jeremiah, where his eyes get shifted off of his dream dying and onto God's love. And when he does, you can hear the hope and you can hear the joy in his voice. You can hear him. How else can you say in this verse, how else can you say, they are new every morning, great is your faithfulness? How else can you say, I say to myself, the Lord is my portion, therefore I will wait for him. The Lord is good to those who hope. How else can you say that unless you just had a resurgence of joy? And it only came when he shifted his gaze from the dream dying to the God who was loving in the midst of it. And so we have to ask the question, because it's a natural question to ask, is God good in the midst of my dream dying? Because this is for the nation of Israel. I mean, Lamentations is Jeremiah lamenting the destruction of Israel, and God was faithful and loving in the midst of dealing with a nation. I'm not Israel. You're not Israel. Like, I'm an individual. I'm not even Israeli. So how in the world is God faithful in my dream dying? Because God was faithful to Israel. Is he faithful to me? Is he faithful in my dream dying? And I want to answer that in two different ways, or kind of two different paths. One is for those of you that have been born again into God's family, and answer that question, is God faithful when your dreams die? And the second part of that question is for those of you that have not been born into his family. Maybe you're here this morning and you're like, I don't really know what I think about this. I mean, you're talking a lot of stuff and some of it makes sense. Some of it just sounds weird. If you're in that situation, I want to answer the question for you too. The first one is this. For those of us that have been born into God's family, you need to look no further than the cross to see God's loving, loyal love, his covenant love, his hesed love in your life. Now, how does this make sense in the midst of your dreams dying? Because sometimes dreams die and we don't know why. But when we look at the cross and we see Jesus dying unjustly for our sin, it puts in perspective. It puts in perspective whether or not God is loving for all time in my life in all circumstances. And the answer is a resounding, emphatic yes. God is loving and kind, loyal love, covenant love in the midst of our dreams dying for those of us that have been born into his family. Not only that, when you were saved, when you crossed the line of faith and were born from death into life, God started a process in your life that will continue for all eternity, and that is the growing of you, the maturing of you, the chiseling of you into the image of Jesus for his glory. And God is working all things. Romans 8:28 says God works all things for good for those who love him. But we can't stop reading there because sometimes we stop reading at Romans 8:28 and we think, well, but this isn't good. We think, I don't like this. I don't like that my dream died or isn't going the way I want. God's not good. But we stop reading at 8:28 and we get good in terms of our little definition of good. And I don't mean to belittle you, but we're not God of the universe, so our definition of good is small. And if we keep reading in Romans 8, we see that God's definition of good is for you to be conformed to the image of Christ for his glory. And everything that happens in your life is part of that process. And all means all. And Aaron and I have thrown ourselves on that word all so many times. Just thrown ourselves on that rock that all means all. And so this doesn't make sense. But if God's working all things for his glory and my good, then this somehow is good. And I don't understand. But if we believe that all means all, then in the midst of your dreams dying as a believer, somehow, in some way, in God's cosmic picture, he's working. And this is hard. You might not see the pieces fit. If you walked into a movie that you didn't know how long it was going, and you were only in there for a minute, and then you walked out, and you didn't know how much longer the movie had, you would see this much of the movie, not knowing how much was before and how much was after. But the part you saw, you understood. But how that part fit in the bigger picture, you had no idea. Not the foggiest clue. And as a believer, so much of our life is like the snippet of that movie that we see, and we understand lots of it. And it was meaningful and it was good, but then we step out of the theater and we're like, what in the world just happened? Like, what's next? How does it fit? And we want quick fixes. In 2017, I want it done now. I want an app to fix my problems or at least tell me what's going on. And as believers, we don't always get that. You might. You might get to see how the pieces fit and praise God, but here's the thing. You might not. And when we read stories like Ruth, we just finished a series on Ruth, and when we read stories like Joseph or David or Moses, we think, oh yeah, if I was in that situation, if I was Ruth or if I was Naomi, I'd have faith. I would have faith in the midst of my dreams dying, and I would stand strong. And I think the reason we think that is because we know the end of their story. We know how Joseph's story ends up and Naomi's story ends up. But when we get into our dream and we don't know how the story ends, we bail on faith. We bail on the confidence, on the throw yourself. I mean, just heave yourself on the rock that says, Jesus Christ is working in my life and God is working for my good and his glory always. We bail on that because we don't know how the story ends. And so how hypocritical it is of me to say I would have faith if I was Joseph or Naomi or Ruth. But then in my own life, in my own story that God is working, to not have that same confidence. Not easy. I mean, this is not easy. I make no claims that this is easy. In fact, many times gut-wrenching. And many of you have experienced things that are unspeakable. And you're listening to my story and you might think, you don't understand my pain. You don't understand. And in all humility, I would just offer to you to come to Lamentations chapter 3 and, like Jeremiah, shift your focus for a moment from your situation to God's unfailing love, present as a believer, promised to you for all time. And for those of you that are not born into God's family, I'm going to say something that's incredibly audacious. I just wanted to preface that so you kind of knew it was coming. So if you want to close your ears, you can. If you're here today and you have not crossed the line of faith, and you're listening to me talking about God being good to those who have been born into his family, let me offer to you that your dream dying might be the best thing that ever happened to you. Audacious, I know. And I don't say that lightly. But in comparison with eternity of being united with God, born into his family, and eternity being forever shut out, there is nothing more important than that. And when your dream dies, you ask big questions. That's a reality. Dreams die, and it pushes us into this wrestling with God. And it might be the best thing that ever happened to you, to come face to face with those questions and ask God to his face, are you loving and kind? And the answer we see in the cross and nowhere else, in the midst of your dreams dying, for somebody who has not been born into his family, you look at the cross, and Romans 5:8 says, God died for you while you were still a sinner, right now. And your dream dying might be the best thing that ever happened to you. By comparison, nothing else matters. And I don't mean to make light of your dream, but from God's view, from that cosmic view, there is nothing else that matters. So where do we go from here? What do we do? You're in the midst of your dreams dying and you feel like you're adrift. And in Aaron and I's story, many times we felt adrift. Like a little boat in a very, very big, very, very violent ocean. The lights go out, the waves get big, and you have no idea where you are. Let me offer to you verse 21. In verse 21 of chapter 3, Jeremiah says, "Yet this I recall." Yet this I recall. Right before this, he says, I well remember them being his sorrows, and my soul is downcast. See, it is natural. Jeremiah says in verse 18, in verse 19, that he remembers his suffering all the time. It is natural. We are just there. Our flesh and our culture makes our vision be on ourselves. And we will always, always go back to us being at the center of our story. We will always come back to us being the main character of our story. And Jeremiah says, look, I recall. That's an intentional word. This didn't come naturally to Jeremiah. He didn't just wake up in the midst of Jerusalem being destroyed. I mean, he's probably writing this up on a hill, looking down at the city, probably still smoldering. He doesn't just wake up and go, God is awesome. It is an intentional thing. I mean, he's probably not even feeling it at first. He's probably not even feeling good. He is painstakingly intentional. He is grinding this into his head. He is tattooing it on his body. He is doing whatever he can to keep this in front of his face, that God's covenant love never fails. And we have to be intentional. When your dreams die, it's like your compass just gets spun. And you're like, I don't even know which way's north anymore. It gets dark. We were in dark places when our dreams were going through hard times. And we still are in many situations. Your compass gets spun and you don't know what's north. But you have to be intentional. I mean, painstakingly intentional. And here's how you be intentional. Every verse of chapter 3 is a quotation of Scripture. It's either a reference to Old Testament Scripture or it's a direct quotation. Jeremiah is recalling to mind things that he has instilled in his brain. He is calling to mind God's covenant love as evidenced by his past faithfulness to Israel. You have to do the same thing. You have to do it for God's faithfulness to Israel. You have to go back and tell yourself stories of God's faithfulness in your own life. And as a believer, you have the ultimate story of God's faithfulness to you on the moment when you were born from death to life. And if you can't think of any other evidence of God's faithfulness to you, then go back to that story and tell yourself that story over and over again. But it's got to be intentional, because if you don't, we drift. We just do. We naturally drift. Our culture tells us to focus on self, and as soon as you start focusing on self, you get small, and you start interpreting everything around you as how it affects me. Is this good for me? Do I like this? Do I like the way this feels? Is my dream going well? And we get small, and we bring the God of the universe down into our definition of good. And Jeremiah says, no, no, you turn your focus to the God of covenant love. And so here's a couple things you can do today, like right this second. This might sound hokey, this might sound weird, but I think we should all do it together. I do this all the time. Just whisper under your breath that the steadfast love of the Lord never fails. The NIV doesn't translate this verse, steadfast. It translates it great love. But steadfast is kind of an old word, and it has this idea of being anchored. So say it right now, under your breath, the steadfast love of the Lord never fails. Just whisper it. Nobody else has to hear it. The steadfast love of the Lord never fails. And when you whisper it, the steadfast love of the Lord never fails, there's something, I hate to use the word mystical, but there's something spiritual about saying something out loud, even if nobody else hears it, but saying it out loud, you feel your lips moving, your ears hear you, you're saying it intentionally, and saying something out loud has power. So speak truth out loud. That the steadfast love of the Lord never fails. Something else you can do just, you know, in a couple minutes when you drive home is to share stories. Students, I give you a challenge in particular. If you're going to ride home with your parents, I challenge you to ask your parents where they've seen God's faithful love in their lives. You will be blown away at their stories. Spouses, I challenge you to ask your spouse, where have you seen God's faithful love in the last week, the last month, the last year? And if you can't think of anything, then go back to your testimony. Go back to that moment when you crossed from death to life and see afresh God's unfailing love. And then tell that story over again. And over again, and over again. And let it be the thing that you recall. When Jeremiah says, yet I recall the great love of God. Yet I recall God's unfailing love. Yet I recall God's unfailing love, his loyal love. Let that be the thing that you recall. And finally, I would just challenge you to memorize some verses that you can let be the recall. Let that be the running script of your mind. Lamentations 3:22, just memorize it. Memorize it and let it be the thing that is just on recall, that when you're driving in the car and it's in between songs on the radio and your mind kind of goes blank for just a second, this is the thing that you recall. Because if it's not intentional, if you don't have a push button, recall God's faithfulness, you will drift, because we do it naturally. We do it naturally. Or memorize Romans 8:28 and plant those reminders around your day. Plant them around your day. And when you do, I think you'll start to experience that change that Jeremiah experienced in chapter 3, that change from being focused on the dream dying to the God of covenant love who is loving at all times, even in the midst of our dreams dying. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, I want to thank you so much that you love us and that you demonstrated that love by dying for us. I mean, God, what greater love is there than for you to die while we were still sinners? And God, when our dreams die, when we experience that loss and the confusion, God, I pray that you would help us to recall these truths, recall them immediately, and to put before us the reminder that you are loving at all times, even in the midst of our dreams dying. God, I pray for each person here that in their unique situation, I don't know what they're going through with their dreams, but God, I pray that whatever it is, God, they would experience your unfailing love. I pray these things in Jesus' name. Amen.